after what seemed like an absolute lifetime of counting, and a result that is very far away from the landslide that many of us had hoped for, America has finally decided. Trump, you've got to go. But as the president refuses to concede, and is formally in office until January the 20th next year, it seems premature to declare this one over. So today we ask, is the game finally up for Americans' authoritarian menace? And what does this crisis-racked century have in store for us next? Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we're joined by Nick Dearden, a regular contributor, returning to the show to help us make sense of what happened across the pond. He heads up Global Justice Now, the NGO leading the fight against a Brexit trade deal with the United States. And after chewing over the election result and its aftermath, we'll be asking him what we can expect from Biden's trade policy. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. Before we get going, here's a quick message from Elena.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
So the dust has settled a bit on the US election now, but I will say that it's currently 13th of November, Friday morning, and this will go out a few days later. I should say that just because it feels like such a fast-moving situation and there's no such thing as stability. Now, saying that, it does seem to have reached at least some kind of interregnum. So Zoe, do you want to kick off by giving us the rundown of where we are?
The rundown is that Joe Biden does appear to have won. Okay. And there's a kind of desire or hunger, if you like, to kind of see it as more ambiguous than it is, just because the situation is so peculiar that, you know, it's in the Liberals' DNA to try and find a middle ground between Trump saying there's been fraud and everybody else saying there's been no fraud. And so you want to portray it as a very close result. It's not a very close result. Biden has won quite emphatically. It's not a landslide, but it is quite an emphatic win. And I think the anxiety around Trump not leaving office is misplaced. I think he will leave office. I think the background music about how much kind of voter fraud there was is simply an attempt by him to kind of, you know, keep his base alive and form this kind of constituency of people who feel that the election was stolen. But I don't think it's a serious constitutional attempt to deny changing hands. I don't know whether you agree with that.
What do you reckon, Nick?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I would say, like, we're all feeling a little bit lifted by the fact that Trump has been defeated, and that's completely understandable. But I think we do have to remember that he's still got a serious number of votes, and that what he's done to radicalize and mobilize that part of American society, like probably a much bigger part than we realized, is still there and is going to last for a long time. So, I mean, I agree with Zoe, actually, that I don't think he's going to be able to mobilize enough support for any kind of coup or anything like that, which was obviously what we were once worried about. And I do think he will leave, though, of course, he may do so under particularly chaotic circumstances. But especially with coronavirus, you know, I mean, if he just allows that to rip through America for another couple of months, I mean, that could be really very, very serious in terms of the scenario that Biden inherits. But I mean, I do really worry about long-term where American society is going, because if 70 million people can still vote for a guy who's behaved in the way he's behaved over the last 4 years, that's frankly terrifying. And so I think that, you know, what we're looking at now is how able Biden is going to be to offer a really serious alternative to the politics of Trumpism. Because if he can't do that, we're in a really desperate place in 4 years' time.
Yeah, completely. And I suppose it's been a bad election for opinion polling again, just because the opinion polls in advance were essentially predicting a Biden landslide, insofar as there's ever a landslide in American presidential elections. They were predicting 8-point leads, 10-point leads in some cases, 7-point leads. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it would probably be enough for 350, 380, 400 even electoral college votes in the peculiar system that the Americans have to decide who becomes president. And so we didn't get that. In the end, I think it's fair to say it's a narrow Biden victory, but with the qualification that where I think the opinion polls went wrong was that they, I don't think, were really anticipating Trump increasing his vote by 3 million. So in a way, the Biden surge happened. The Biden surge is the largest popular vote haul in American political history. Increased is the margin. I think he got 5 million more votes than Trump in the end. I mean, the final result is still not quite in, but it's looking like it's in that range. So there was a surge of support for Biden, and it probably was in that sense, you know, a referendum on Trump. But the really surprising thing is that after the 4 years that we've had, and Trump being not only shockingly racist and chaotic and, you know, all of the incredible facets that he has in his political personality, but then on top of that to have coronavirus as well, and for that to be a complete calamity, and then furthermore for him not actually to deliver on a lot of his economic program that he promised 4 years ago to deliver on. You know, remember, this was really quite a left-wing sounding campaign that he was going to reindustrialize the Rust Belt of the United States and stuff. He didn't deliver on that. So taking that all together, he still increased his vote by 3 million.
I know, but the thing is, where I think commentary and pollsters go really wrong is in evaluating the kind of climate we're in now by the lights of kind of the late 20th century, when politics was just very different then. It kind of iterated and retreated and iterated again, and the differences weren't that stark, and everybody maintained kind of a basic level of courtesy and mutual respect. And as we were talking before we started recording, I had a lot of problems with 90s and noughties politics, but everybody was much more similar then. We are in a very different world where the language of politics has become much more binary, and the kind of way debates unfold has become much more pugilistic. And frankly, well, you know, we say, oh my God, Trump, after all his racism, has still gained this many votes. That means this many people are racist. I think actually what's happened is that people have just stopped listening to the other side. So if you call Trump a racist, somebody who's a Republican, a kind of dyed-in-the-wool Republican, just thinks you're doing one of those liberal slurs that liberals do. And similarly, if whatever Trump says about Biden, Democrats are just thinking, well, this is just nonsense. And so there's very little porousness between the two sides. There's very little space for discursive power to actually shift opinion. And actually, the more people attack Trump for his corona response or his racism or his authoritarianism, the more his base just kind of zones that out and takes that as a kind of outrageous slur against him. So I wasn't at all surprised that his base remained kind of pretty vigorous. And I wasn't particularly surprised that he wasn't obliterated. The other thing is the whole kind of coronavirus effect, and I've really noticed this with Boris Johnson as well. At the beginning, when there are kind of decisions to make and you either procure PPE effectively or not effectively, you either do test and trace systems effectively or not effectively, there was a huge amount of critique of both Trump and Johnson. As the virus has kind of run riot through the populations, and also even countries that dealt with it much better have still been kind of repeatedly kind of hit by it, I think a lot of people are just starting to think no leader could really deal with this. No leader would have been any better than Trump. And somehow the initial blame that accrued around him just ebbed away.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. I mean, it's so complex, isn't it, trying to understand all of this, and there's so many perspectives. I'm actually just watching the Trump show now on the iPlayer because I couldn't watch it while the election was still in doubt. But I'm watching it now, and it's absolutely phenomenal to me. I've actually forgotten most of the things that are impeachable that Trump did over the last 4 years. I was kind of watching it and like, oh, yeah, I remember that. You know, just the blatant corruption and illegality of some of this stuff that is just kind of washed up. But the other thing that really came across, and it came across in the election, is he's a phenomenally entertaining and compelling character. I mean, you're absolutely drawn towards the drama of it all, you know, in a horrible way, obviously. But for a society, you know, and I'm not particularly saying America is so much worse than our society on this, for a society kind of addicted to the entertainment value of politics and only really interested in that, I mean, he's a very entertaining and compelling character. And that's clearly how he's run his entire presidency. And quite a lot of people kind of enjoy that and are driven on by the enthusiasm. It's a bit like you say, Zoe, if you go back to the 90s, how boring politics was in many ways. I mean, you know, I was out on the streets as part of the anti-globalization movement or whatever, and we were looking at mainstream politics, and it was just so bland and dull. And Trump has provided many ordinary Americans with a way to engage in politics, almost like the old Roman crowd at the arena or the races or whatever. People are really engaged and they really feel something. And we've really got to work out on the left how we can engage people in a meaningful and obviously non-racist way. But, you know, I continue to say to both those who support Biden and those who support Starmer, you cannot simply go back to this kind of 90s, you know, we are good technocratic managers of society and of the economy. You know, people want to be engaged in how society is run, and we need to provide them a better way of doing that than Trump has provided.
But I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot since a podcast we did with Gary Stevenson. He's now an academic in equality, and he's looking at wage stagnation and how capital is distributed and how much of it goes to wages and precariousness, and describing something that we all know, which is that the experience of being on the minimum wage or the living wage, as George Osborne used to call it, is that you literally don't know whether you can feed yourself or your children at the end of the week. And that, as an experience of living, that feels like you've been stolen from, because you have. You know, there is no reason in the physical world why a full-time job now cannot provide for a family when 10 years ago or 20 years ago it could provide for a family. There's no reason for it except that that money is going somewhere else. That money is going to shareholders, or that money is going to capital. And Luke asked Gary about political engagement. You know, how do we actually engage people? If we've got a kind of left-wing program, why is it that we find it so difficult to engage people who we should be able to engage? And he said, basically, when you feel like somebody's stealing your money, you don't want to talk about politics. You want somebody to call the police, you know, you want somebody to actually deal with this. And I really think this is really relevant for Biden and Starmer, that it's not really about kind of how do we build a left-wing politics in which everybody kind of cares about equality. It's more that you say, it isn't fair what's happening to you. It isn't fair. And that is where Trump did so well in 2016. And that, I think, is why he didn't win in 2020, because Biden was kind of feeling his way towards this is unjust. But until the left makes a really full-throated case for people to be able to live on their wages, it will not succeed, because the rest of it is just blah.
Yeah, some of this goes back to, I don't want to over-academicize it, but some of this goes back to what Carl Polanyi said in the Second World War, when he was talking about what happens when you just allow the market to run roughshod over society and make all of the key decisions about your lives. There will be a counter-reaction to that. And part of that counter-reaction is people will reach out for security. People will reach out for an alternative to a market-driven society. And they don't care very much, by and large, whether they're reaching out towards fascism or towards socialism or whatever, but they will reach out for security, because that market-based society can't really exist in the long term. It's unsustainable, the damage it does to all of us and our environment and whatever. And Trump, in a way, I mean, regardless of what his actual policies were, appeared to offer something different, appeared to offer that security and that protection that was an answer to the injustice that burns within people, quite rightly, as a result of the society that they live in.
Yeah, I definitely didn't expect Trump to increase his vote haul by 3 million, but maybe I should have done, in the sense that I spent a fair bit of time watching the Trump campaign's videos on YouTube and watching the Biden campaign's video on YouTube, and there's no comparison, to be honest, with the caveat that Biden did win the presidential election, so maybe he didn't need to win the YouTube war. But, I mean, Trump's videos we probably can learn from, because if we put aside the disinformation, the fact that he has no regard for the truth whatsoever, the message is extremely direct and actually extremely working class in its orientation. So, you know, to give you one example, the Trump campaign in this election made a big appeal to black voters, black male voters, on the basis of what their policy of the Opportunity Zone, which was presented to black voters as an exercise in regeneration, bringing jobs to deprived black communities. Actually, the content of this policy is just gentrification. You know, there are all these terrible stories in the New York Times and elsewhere about how you've just had huge hotels and, you know, resorts built next door to poor communities that no one can afford to shop in or anything. So there's an element of cynicism and disinformation. But as an aesthetic, these were really powerful videos with black workers in them talking about how Trump had improved their lives. And that kind of emotional quality you just didn't have in the Biden campaign, or anything like the same directness.
I watched the final debate, to be honest, with horror, because the lack of key messages that came across from Biden was absolutely astonishing and really very frightening. And it was a rerun in some ways of what Clinton tried to do, which is just, I'm a nicer person. You know, I'm clearly a nicer person than this, but nothing else really came over in terms of what they stood for.
Definitely, I think Joe Biden's age is a problem, because he's very much living the political reality that formed him, which was the political reality of the 80s and 90s. And AOC would have been a much better candidate, because she kind of understands what the challenges are now. And she understands that you can't just say, look at me, I seem decent, or even look at me, I've worked in a bar just like you. If we're in a binary politics, your binary has to be really, really strong. And his wasn't. But, you know, in the end, they could have fielded anyone, because in 2016, it wasn't completely obvious who he was. It was obvious enough that he was a very dishonest person, but it wasn't completely obvious how corrupt he was or how authoritarian he was. In 2020, anybody who is against corruption and authoritarianism had to vote Democrat.
To go back to what Nick said at the outset, actually, this was an anti-authoritarianism election, much more than it was a pro-Biden election. I mean, we've all met, I think, American leftists that were in swing states that didn't vote for Hillary Clinton and felt pretty stupid about it afterwards in 2016, pretty guilty about it afterwards in 2016, but they didn't expect Trump to win. And I think on this occasion, there was a completely different dynamic amongst those voters. The question, though, is that in the midterms in 2022, the next presidential election in 2024, it seems like the alignment of forces in the Republican Party will produce another authoritarian candidate, and it will be another authoritarian candidate who is potentially much more professional, much more slick, much more competent, maybe younger in the entire presentation of the thing. And the question I'm asking myself is, how important will the Trump dynasty and the Trump family be? Or will the authoritarianism take a different form? Because to be honest, there is, okay, Trumpism, I think, is a particular thing with its own logic and politics. But within the wider landscape of the Republican Party, you know, the Tea Party revolution, the Marco Rubio phenomenon, who came second to Trump in the 2016 nomination. I mean, these guys are really, really, really reactionary too. So it means that in your kind of choices of what the opposition will be to Biden, for the Republican opposition that will once again get tens of millions of votes at least next time, you know, it's going to be another far-right candidate. So the far-right are going to be back in American politics.
I feel like the Trump family is over now. If you look at any of the individual children, none of them has the Trump appeal. I think that's a very kind of Cromwell thing, that he was kind of a specific man for that specific point in politics, and there is no dynasty to continue that. It's certainly not like a Bush situation. The best historical analogy I can think of for Trump is Kaiser Wilhelm II. Miranda Carter wrote a brilliant thing in The New Yorker about how actually by the beginning of the First World War, the Kaiser had kind of shuffled off and was no part of it, but he'd corroded the institution so profoundly with his kind of vanity and corruption and overall insufficiency to the office that it was sort of a chaos that ensued, which created all that poison rather than any direct successor. There's nobody you can point to and say, well, he was definitely the heir to Kaiser Wilhelm, but the whole period was the heir to that government. And I think the same will be true in America, that, you know, he has done some really serious damage to American institutions and just hollowed them out. And the Supreme Court is the obvious problem. But I think more broadly, he's culled a lot of expertise, and that will tell for a long time to come.
And Zoe, you said at the outset that you think the transition will be okay, this sort of bizarre situation that you have in the United States where you wait one fifth of a year about that in order to change the government after an election. I think you're probably right, but I suppose there has been this discussion in advance. There's an academic project called the Transition Integrity Project, which was basically wargaming what happens when Trump refuses to concede. And some of the constitutional and political argument around it is pretty interesting and pretty compelling, because they basically start from the assumption that the Constitution presumes a peaceful transfer of power. It doesn't actually mandate it very explicitly. And so Trump's refusal to concede and leave office does create this grey area, and he still has the most powerful office on planet Earth that he heads up at the moment, right now, as he's still the president of the United States. And the scenario that we're now in is quite close to what they described as the narrow Biden win. Okay, it wasn't that narrow, but that's kind of the scenario that we're in. And they gamed it out and they said Trump will refuse to concede, and there will have to be at some point huge mass demonstrations in the US. And the key consideration, which I think we're seeing playing out quite positively, is that the mainstream Republican Party is gradually breaking away from Trump. Now, the thing that really scares me, and I think this was in the scenario that the Integrity Project anticipated too, is that there is a clear danger of white riots in the United States in the next 2 months to attack the democratic process. And you've seen incredibly inflammatory language in this regard. Donald Trump Jr. went to Atlanta and told Trump supporters to fight to the death.
Fight each and every one of these battles to the death.
To defend Trump's position in office. I mean, it's really terrifying stuff. So I don't think it's quite over yet in terms of this.
Two things. One is, if you want to do a serious coup, you have to have a better relationship with the armed forces than Trump does. So he can have his white riots, and I'm not saying they won't be very ugly, but, or they couldn't be very ugly, but I frankly don't think they could make any more difference to the process than the kind of anti-globalization protests in Seattle. It was, you know, years ago, not the current Portland ones. I think they can cause a big kind of splash, but I don't think they can actually change the process. The other thing is, of course, that Trump has to think about not his legacy, but his future impeachment. And he'll be thinking about the jeopardy to him personally from the various things, almost anything from Russian involvement through corruption, through the kind of multiple sexual harassment charges that have been laid against him. He needs to think about how he can get ahead of that and pardon himself. And he can't pardon himself. In order to kind of have a prophylactic pardon, I read something that said he could actually resign 10 days before or even one day before transition. And then Mike Pence could be president for a day just in order to pardon Trump, pardon him in advance from any future charges. And that is a kind of, that's going to be a consideration for him, because if he can't pardon himself and, you know, the kind of protocol that the next president would pardon him as Nixon was pardoned wouldn't necessarily hold. I don't see why Biden would do that for him. He does have to think about how to get that away. So I think self-interest will ensure his stepping down. And everything else, all the kind of heat and noise around it, is just to kind of create himself, if anything, a media base so that he can go on to his next act, which will be like as a shock jock or something.
Yeah, he is facing very serious charges, isn't he, if I understand it correctly, both in terms of like bankruptcy, but also in terms of quite serious criminal charges that he could be facing, which obviously makes him even more dangerous, I guess, than he would otherwise be, because in some ways he's got nothing left to lose. But I agree, if there's a potential way out for him there, self-interest could potentially prevail. But I also just think there's a difference between what happens to Trump now and what happens to some of those parts of the country he's mobilized, those sectors of society he's mobilized, because, I mean, in a way, this has been going on in America for, you know, since independence. I mean, that the serious, serious, often violent debates and disagreements in American society about what kind of country it is, who it exists for, you know, they've been going on a very, very long time. And they obviously created a really horrific war in the country in the 19th century. And I don't feel it's ever really been resolved. And what Trump has done has definitely been to open up the wound in a particularly horrible and explicit way. But those dynamics are certainly not going away without serious, serious transformation of that country.
Hello, it's Anna here. I wanted to let you know about a really important campaign that I'm involved in. In Poland, abortion rights are currently under attack like never before. But the resistance is huge. Women and their allies have taken the streets in unprecedented numbers. Another Europe has been helping organize protests and build international solidarity with Polish women, because we believe that reproductive rights shouldn't stop at borders. So please support this struggle and consider joining Another Europe if possible today.
So unless American democracy completely collapses, and hopefully it won't in the next 2 months, Biden is going to become president of the United States. Could you run through what we know about the US-UK trade deal, which is currently being negotiated with the Trump administration and the Johnson administration, and how you expect Biden to change things or not?
Yeah, so about 10 days ago, the British government told us that those negotiations were going extremely well and that most chapters were nearly finalised. And the impression they gave, of course, it's very difficult to verify any of this because it's all taking place in secret and so on. But the impression that they gave is, you know, another few months or weeks of negotiation and it will be there in a form that you could begin to actually put legal language on it and then send it to Congress. So potentially we have a pretty advanced deal that's been negotiated here. The British government now clearly has a problem because there certainly isn't time to get that deal through Congress before Trump leaves office. And what that means is they will definitely need Democrat support for this to go through. They have an additional problem, which is that if this deal is not placed in Congress by April, it is unlikely to get through Congress before presidential trade authority expires in July. And what that means is it's much harder to get a trade deal through. I mean, at that point, Congress can go through every single line and object to stuff and change stuff and whatever. So it becomes difficult after that point. There are still ways they could do it. They could potentially get special trade promotion authority just for this deal to pass through. But they are, in all senses, it's a kind of race against the clock if they want this done anytime soon. The other thing we know is that Biden is not particularly interested in signing trade deals. He has a solidly domestic focus. And I think, you know, that's clearly the right approach to take, given, you know, America has been hit so badly by the pandemic. The economy is really in free fall. He will need to put all of his energy into working out how to rebuild the country. And the idea that he's got loads of time on his hands for chatting to Johnson about something which is fairly marginal from the American side is probably fanciful. So I think a lot of what it depends upon is whether the British can convince enough Democrats that really there's nothing too controversial in here from their side, and therefore win enough support to get this through, you know, fairly under the radar, just get it done and get it passed. That's their challenge. And we simply don't know how possible that will be. We don't know precisely what Biden thinks about this trade deal. I wrote in The Guardian this week that while there are elements to it that Biden might not like, we have to remember that American trade deals are fueled by American corporate interests, by the interests of the big agricultural lobbies, the big pharmaceutical lobbies, and the big tech lobbies. And those things clearly haven't changed. I mean, there's nothing about a Trump defeat that removes the power of those lobbies. And we know from past experience that Biden has been very supportive of corporate trade deals like TTIP. So there is a lot to still be worried about, but there is also a lot to be worried about from the British government's perspective. We are in a better situation than we were 2 weeks ago.
I mean, what do you think of the rumour that Biden's team doesn't want to deal with Johnson and, well, Cummings is now irrelevant, but doesn't want to deal with the British government at all?
Well, I'm a bit sceptical of that, to be honest. I mean, look, I don't for a moment think that Biden likes Johnson. I mean, Biden has a very, you know, strong sense of his own Irish identity. He is not in any way impressed with the way that Brexit has been handled, or indeed, you know, the fact that Brexit is even happening, which he just thinks is a whole kind of mini Trump thing. So, and, you know, some of the things clearly that Johnson has said and some of his backbenchers have said, I mean, I was astonished as the election count was going on, actually, at the way that some Tory MPs were taking to Twitter to back Trump's ludicrous and dangerous claims about voting irregularity and so forth. So, you know, for all those reasons, I'm sure, you know, there's not a great deal of personal sympathy from Biden towards Johnson. Having said that, you know, I mean, does that really matter when it comes down to negotiating something that business interests want? Who knows? But I'm skeptical it would make that much difference. And it was interesting, I think, was it earlier this week when Biden decided that Johnson was, after all, going to be the first European leader that he spoke to by phone. You know, the kind of suggestion that how he feels personally about Johnson is really going to get in the way is overblown.
And let's have a quick chat about the relationship of it to the EU deal, because reading between the lines of what Biden is saying, his basic argument around the Good Friday Agreement, that is absolutely needs to be protected, and that he's against the internal market bill that puts in question the provisions of the Good Friday Agreement. The logic of that means that the UK would have to do a deal with the EU in order for a deal with the US Biden administration to be in play at all. And that's a really big shift in the geopolitics of the situation, because Trump and the Trump administration basically want to destroy the EU. They've been pretty open that they think that the EU should go. They don't see it as a good project or in America's interests at all. And clearly Biden doesn't have that view at all. He wants to work with the EU in this quite conventional transatlantic partnership type way. So it does change the Brexit calculation for Johnson a lot, I think. I mean, it makes, even if he was seriously considering a no deal before, I think it makes it much harder for him to pursue that. And then, like, secondly, I think in terms of what you're saying, Nick, as well, about how Biden would negotiate a trade deal in general and the general corporate interests that underline US trade policy, you know, really the problem for an American deal is on the British side, right? It's to do with potential implications for the National Health Service, and it's to do with agribusiness and food standards, all of the things that you have been raising. But you also, if I understand rightly, have this analysis that some of Biden's election promises mean that it will be quite difficult for him to give the British what they want in a US trade deal from the American side too, right?
That's right, yeah. So it's a really important point that you started off with there, which is that Trump had an actual rationale for why he wanted to do this deal. You know, Trump believes there are two power bases that threaten United States dominance in the world. One is the EU, one is China. We know how he's behaved towards China and how he's used trade there to try to weaken China's hand, and he's done the same with the EU. And for him, Brexit was this wonderful way of pulling a major economy out of the EU and towards America's orbit. So there is a rationale there that no longer exists, that Biden doesn't feel. And as you say, he actually wants to get on with the EU in a very different way. And probably if it was up to him, would prioritise trade talks if he was going to do any at all with the EU rather than the UK. So you're right, that's important. And also completely right in that they have to find a way of dealing with the Good Friday Agreement and Ireland, because that is the thing that could really throw a spanner in the works in Congress in particular. I think on the second point, yes, that is true. So Biden has talked a lot about the need to stimulate the American economy through, for example, use of America's enormous procurement budget. I mean, just think about how much America spends on the military before you think about anything else, you know, hundreds of billions. There are massive procurement contracts in there. Same with a lot of state spending as well, by the way. One of the main things that Britain has always wanted is to weaken that Buy American stuff, because it wants our providers of services to be able to bid for those contracts and to benefit from those contracts. I mean, you know, we are world leaders in handing over our public sector to private corporations, and we want those private corporations to have the same rights or privileges in the United States as they do here. And Biden has said really clearly, no, we will be strengthening, not weakening, Buy America. This is all part of how we plan to recover from coronavirus. And you can argue about, you know, whether that's a good strategy or not. I think it's got a fair bit to be said for it, but kind of depends how it's done. But nonetheless, that means that any British win out of this is very, very likely to be reduced by Biden's own strategy. And what that means is that Britain will be forced to accept lots of things it doesn't want to accept and are very unpopular here in return for very little. I think the thing that I'm not sure about at the moment is how much the British government care about that, because for the last few years we know, and it's very surprising coming from a Tory government, that the economic reality of what they're gaining and losing in this whole process of Brexit is less important to them than the politics and the kind of long-term electoral advantage. So they've just done this deal with Japan, which was kind of just a rollover deal of the one that the EU's got, but with a few tweaks here and there, that they then presented as this wonderful, isn't this wonderful how this is, how great Brexit is. I mean, even coming up with that ridiculous tweet on soy sauce, that we would be reducing tariffs on soy sauce, which was just a lie. We would only be reducing them if you assumed that we were doing a hard cliff-edge Brexit and going to WTO terms. But they didn't really care about that. They didn't care that on their own assessment, the majority of the advantage of this trade deal goes to Japanese exporters, not British exporters. It's a political stunt for them. And I imagine that the American deal, they're thinking about in a very similar way. So, you know, for them at the moment, do they actually even really care about economic advantage, or are they purely interested in making Brexit look like a success? And linking us, of course, I mean, the long-term strategy for Truss and others, linking us with this very market-driven, deregulated economic model that an American trade deal would help cement in place.
I really get that sense of, like, Johnson running out of steam. I mean, I feel like maybe the whole kind of dream of doing a deal with Trump and it being politically really easy to sell, and then Trump not being elected and Biden throwing a spanner in the works with the Good Friday Agreement and his commitment to it, etc., will just end up looking like such a kind of Gordian knot to Johnson, who's got, you know, very little application on a personal level anyway, that he'll just end up thinking sod it and making what is essentially a kind of single market deal with the EU.
I know you're in a really optimistic mood today, Zoe.
And I would like to believe that too, but I'm just really sceptical that that can be achieved at this point, to be honest with you. Just in terms of the deadline for negotiating with the EU, you know, Johnson's continuing insistence that there's going to be no extension with the transition period. I mean, who knows? I really don't know what they're going to come up with. So it's possible, but I'm just really sceptical, first of all, that they have the kind of competence to do that. Secondly, that they feel the political dynamic suits a solution like that, given how much they've based themselves on Brexit will be a success and we'll get it done and so on. And thirdly, that I think there is surely still a very strong element, whether in Johnson's head or not, at least in those around the cabinet table with him, that this is our big chance to shock the British economy into a different form, into something which is more market-driven, more deregulated, more liberalised. And the big chance to do that is drawing us closer to the American economy. And are they going to
to throw that away, even if it looks like it's going to be really bad for us in the short term. I'm not sure. And how much is this tied up with the whole Cummings leaving? You know, I really have no idea whether this is a kind of strategic reset that's going on inside Number 10 now, or it's just the same old kind of chaotic incompetence, but basically the same values are driving them, which is, you know, the stuff that Truss, Rab and others set out in Britannia Unchained 10 years ago.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this pod is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we talk about coronavirus, remember that? And the great news that we finally got a vaccine. But the problem with patents and how we need the whole world to share in this discovery so that it doesn't just benefit private profit and the rich world. It's a good chat. If you want to listen to it, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the European left in Britain. You can join us at anothereurope.org/join. It doesn't cost much, makes a big difference, and gets you access to that extra content. So we've got a vaccine. Well, hey, it seems that Pfizer and their partner have developed a vaccine with an up to 90% immunity protection from the virus. So it's been a pretty extraordinary week in news on coronavirus with a rare bit of good news. Now, one of the reactions to this on Twitter, I think quite tongue-in-cheek, from the Twitter left was critical support for Big Pharma, we're all saved. Now I noticed, Nick, that you haven't been joining in with this reaction, even in a tongue-in-cheek way.
Oh, you're just confirming what a pessimist I am, that I'm not even happy that there's this enormous vaccine breakthrough going on. Look, I think there's two things to be said. First of all, we've got a report I'm just writing this week, actually, which is going to be out soon, looking at the history of Pfizer, and it's not a pretty one. And I think we've got every reason to be skeptical and cynical about their ability to make this available to everybody who needs it in the world. There's some really worrying stuff in that history. I mean, it's fascinating as well that we haven't actually seen much of the data yet. So we've got their press release and we've got what they say about it. A lot of scientists are saying this isn't really how it's done. You're not supposed to release this kind of stuff to the media without, you know, our ability to actually scrutinize the data behind it. And it was really interesting that the same day they released it, the CEO of Pfizer cashed in a load of his shares for $5.5 million. So you can see what's driving, you know, some of these folks. Pfizer has already sold the vast majority of its vaccines to rich countries. So despite all the promises we've had that there's going to be a fair distribution system throughout the world that's going to make sure the most vulnerable get it first in global terms, despite all of that, almost all the vaccines that Pfizer will be able to produce next year have been gobbled up by rich countries. And Pfizer expects to make $13 billion just in the next year. So, you know, the problem here is we've got a pharmaceutical system which is deeply dysfunctional because it is driven by kind of monopoly privileges that are embedded in trade law and the desire to make absolutely vast profits rather than thinking about, you know, how we can help improve the health of all of humanity. And I think it's a real problem, not just in terms of immediately who's going to get these vaccines, but also the enormous vaccine skepticism that's rising and that I'm very scared and worried about, but I think is part and parcel of a system where people know that vaccine developments and so on are really driven by the desire for profit more than anything else. So I'm worried about a lot of different aspects of this question, but the thing that I will be hopeful about is I think it's forced a lot of people to reconsider how we should do medical research and development. The Labour Party passed a brilliant policy last year at its conference, pledged it to reform the pharmaceutical system, take bits of it into public ownership, produce patent-free medicines, wonderful stuff. There is now a big push by Global South countries to suspend international patent rules at the WTO. There is a real movement gathering pace, which we've, to be honest, needed for a very long time, not just for coronavirus. You know, antibiotics are becoming resistant. Big Pharma don't have any interest in creating any new antibiotics. Our entire medical knowledge is threatened by this. So slightly longer term, I am actually optimistic that this could create the kind of change if we push for it that we've needed for a very, very long time. But I am skeptical that Pfizer is going to save humanity.
I agree with that. And I think that there's a philosophical question in a way of, is vaccine nationalism viable in this global health context? And what I mean by that is clearly there are
expressions of vaccine nationalism. I think you've pointed out that the UK has put in orders for vaccines that are 4 or 5 times the size of the UK population. So the idea that the UK needs that quantity is absurd. So that's a good illustration of vaccine nationalism. What I mean by it not being necessarily viable is that coronavirus is this huge leveler in a way, because it's a global pandemic. It means that no one is really safe and secure, and the global economy can't really recover from it until everyone has the access to the vaccine, right? So it poses this really strong universal question of this needs to be delivered to billions of people, the billions of people on planet Earth, in order for it to provide effective protection and for the world economy to have any hope of recovering. So suspending patent rules becomes actually a really practical demand that we need this vaccine to be produced in as many places as possible, as quickly as possible, in order for the whole world to get out of this crisis.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I really hope that people come to that conclusion and aren't kind of carried away by the technical genius of the scientists at Pfizer, who, by the way, I'm sure have been working, you know, extremely hard on this. But the fact is that without patent rules, without the very perverse financialized incentives built into the pharma system, we might already have a vaccine. The fact is that after SARS and whatever else, they were already researching it, and they just dropped all that research because there was no interest in them for it. So I very much hope that's right. Of course, you can also envisage a really quite dark scenario where, you know, basically those countries or individuals that haven't been vaccinated because they can't get hold of it or can't afford it, you know, we have a kind of two-tier passport system that dictates who's allowed to travel and under what conditions, which is a much darker, you know, the West looks after itself essentially, and the rest of the world is deeply screwed, not only by lack of access to the vaccine, but by lack of access to finance in order to rebuild their societies. I mean, the debt crisis is another thing we're working on. And, you know, it looks today like Zambia might default, and it could be the first of many, many countries to go through this process, simply because the governments of the rich world and their banks are continuing to bleed these countries of debt repayments during a pandemic. So I think there is every reason to fight as hard as we can for something better here, because I think it's really possible. But I also think there is a kind of nightmare scenario that we've got to be aware of, because hopefully that will give us a little bit more energy to campaign in the way that we need to.
Okay. I mean, I still want to make one kind of word of respect for the scientists, because even though the incentives in Big Pharma are kind of perverse and anti-humanitarian in a way, there is a huge amount of expertise and knowledge sharing between the various people attempting to produce a vaccine. And you know, Sir John Bell on the UK Vaccine Commission said the success of the Pfizer vaccine actually made the Oxford vaccine closer to its final stages as well. And on some level, at least, they are working to try and end the pandemic. And it's not all market driven. There is a kind of genuine lust for knowledge and life-saving that kind of makes cross-pollination a thing. Whereas if it were totally market driven, it wouldn't be.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, without getting too carried away with the ideology underlying some of the statements, I do think it is an incredible moment for science and for humanity. I can't remember who it was who said that on the radio. But I mean, it's pretty phenomenal for this virus to be less than a year old still and to have ripped through the globe in the way that it did, for the scientific community to be able to turn around within the space of 10 months and to get a viable working vaccine. And if that scientific capacity was harnessed more effectively, it surely shows that there's any number of things that human societies could achieve if they put their mind to it.
I think that's a brilliant way of putting it, Luke, and that builds on the optimism that I know that you and Zoe want me to adopt today. So I'm going to go with that. But I think we should look at it. That's a really good way of putting it. That yes, let's imagine what would be possible if we removed some of these perverse incentives from the system.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for coming on again, Nick. It's been great.
It's a pleasure.
Really good to chat. We might be able to do an in-person podcast again at some point, and we'll actually be able to be in the same room with one another.
That would be incredibly exciting. I mean, if you weren't moving to Bristol, it would be easier as well. But now I'm worried
about
that.
Oh, yeah, that's true, actually. I'm
worried
to Bristol,
about that. But yes, that would be really nice.
Let's make it happen before you move to Bristol.
All right. Speak to you both soon.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Yeah,
nice to speak to you.
Bye.